On this episode of Mapping Tech and Public Safety, we talk with three members of the GIS Corps about their experience supporting public safety GIS efforts during major incidents. We want to welcome three members of the GIS Corps. Joining us today is German Whitley, Aaron Arkinson, and Holly Torpy. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about their backgrounds and some of the work that the GIS Corps does with public safety GIS. Chris and I would like to welcome all three of you onto our episode. We'd like to start with some introductions.
Hi, I'm German Whitley. I have a GIS background in hydrology and wildfire GIS. I joined GIS Corps as a volunteer in 2010, and 2016, I joined as a Corps committee member. Just a little background on GIS Corps is it was floated as an idea for a volunteer GIS organization by Sheree Elhami, our founder, in 2001. In 2003, Yurissa had adopted GIS Corps as an official part of the program of Yurissa. For 15 years, it was fully volunteer-based. And then in 2018, we were able to hire Holly, who will introduce herself in one moment, as a half-time employee. And she's also a volunteer, and she can tell you more about herself.
Great, thank you.
I'm Holly Torpy. I'm the GIS Administrative Assistant for GIS Corps part-time. I also like volunteering on the projects the rest of my time. I got started with GIS Corps in, well, sort of indirectly, I think it was 2017 as a member of Standby Task Force, which does disaster response projects, not so much, partly a little bit of GIS. I was doing some GIS for them, but it's mostly crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. And we were working in conjunction with GIS Corps volunteers on some disaster response projects. So that was my first exposure to GIS Corps. And then I joined in 2018. And the disaster response projects, even though my own GIS background is not in disaster response or public safety, it's more natural resources, have really been kind of my favorite to work on because they're so rewarding and they're kind of intense. There's a lot of camaraderie and innovation that takes place throughout the project because we don't have a lot of time to plan. We're figuring it out as we go. It's just an exciting way to get to explore different aspects of GIS that you might not be exposed to in your day-to-day work.
That's very cool. So Aaron, tell us a little bit about yourself and what your background is.
My name is Aaron Arkison. I'm in Houston, Texas. I work for an oil and gas company. That's what pays the light bill. I started search and rescue in 2012. Then a few years later, I was at work and I came across one of Esri's magazines, you know, the big giant ones. They were talking about using GIS in search and rescue. I brought the whole magazine to training and I was like, look! Therefore, that started me down the GIS path in public safety search rescue. Through a NASAR conference, I met Paul Doherty. And
everybody knows Paul.
I know. I helped him ask in 2018 with, was it Florence first or her, Michael? I can't remember.
It's all a blur.
Florence, I think. For Hurricane, I met Paul. I got with him during Hurricane Florence to see if he needed any help with his crowdsourcing project that I had seen him start for Harvey. That he kind of put me in contact with German and Holly, and then like the rest, they say, is history. I joined unofficially as like an admin through Paul. And then last year, officially as a member of the GIS Corps, and then they grabbed a hold of me at the end in December to become a Corps committee member for the disaster projects.
That's very cool. You mentioned before we started talking that you also do search and rescue. Briefly, like, describe some of the crossover things between GIS Corps and search and rescue that you do. Surveys, like damage assessment surveys, like with Group 123 or... anything cool like that?
Yes and no, but not for what you're thinking of. I am the only GIS person on the team. When we have a mission, I am the one who just makes all the pre-maps of the search areas, usually sits at base or incident command running as people are coming in and out of dropping their GPS, getting the tracks off, saying this is your next assignment, and compiling all the data and creating all the track maps after it. That's typically in a search environment what I do. We use the Survey 123 and stuff for some of the other efforts that we kind of volunteer for that are less traditional search and rescue. I kind of learned to kind of plug in some of those applications there. We don't really use it because we're not really doing damage assessment. We're just a little volunteer team. So we don't really handle the big disasters. They're going to call the USAR teams for that.
Oh, okay. That's cool. And kind of following the same lines, I'll just kind of toss it to you both, German and Holly. Can you describe like some of the search and rescue pilot projects with some of the activity that the GIS Corps does?
Most of our search and rescue projects have come via Paul and NASA. Which is another way we got Erin, our hooks into Erin, is she was the Mountain Rescue, which is an ongoing project that we have.
The Mountain Rescue Association has a giant data set of missions, and they were kind of handling their own, or with Paul's help mostly. They reach out to GIS Corps to help with some of the back-end data manipulation and combining of the databases. They had a lot of databases that each year had its own thing, and they may have different fields and stuff like that. So they need help combining all of it. They asked me to create the dashboard to put on the website. That was specifically what my job was. And then I can't remember how many of us they were helping on it.
There were five projects.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And everybody had their own like job that they were working on for it. Basically, they just wanted a dashboard so that they could put on the website that said, these are all of our missions.
That's pretty cool. And you can see, like, I had a little bit of ADHD seriously going on, so I tend to bounce around on my questions a bit. So it's like, oh, search and rescue is pretty cool. Let's talk about that. But I should probably step back just a little bit and ask, you know, kind of in broad terms, who volunteers and supports the GIS Corps? You know, what's a typical GIS Corps volunteer? What kind of resources do they need to do their job, and what kind of time commitment?
We have over 7,000 registered volunteers at this time in 132 countries. We've completed, 2,400 volunteers have actually participated in the mission over all the years that we've been doing this. Our volunteers come from everywhere. We usually have a booth at the ESRI User Conference that gets a lot of signups. ESRI publishes those articles like Erin saw that helps us get new members coming in. Word of mouth. We don't do any sort of active advertising to get new members. It's basically a grassroots organization. We all are all volunteers until we brought Holly on in 2018.
Okay.
So for 15 years, it's all volunteer. We have anywhere from a 6 to 9 person core committee, right? 6 members, we can have up to 9, we kind of manage all the projects that come in and deal with the day-to-day operations.
Mm-hmm.
We assign a core committee member to each project. A typical project, we have sort of regular projects and disaster response crowdsource projects, which are two very different things. A typical project, we get a request from a partner agency, a nonprofit typically, and we have to approve the project to make sure that the nonprofit meets our goals and you know what their mission is and if it's something that we can support. We do not do any sort of political projects. That's kind of where we draw the line.
That makes a lot of sense.
How many volunteer members do you have on staff?
7,000. We have 6 core committee members, and then we have a database of 7,000 volunteers. So when a project comes in, we vet the project. We talk to the partner agency. We write up the job description and send it out to our whole volunteer database. And we filter those who we send it to based on what skills are needed. If it's really specialty skills, we can filter down to, the announcement goes out to 100 people, maybe it goes out to 1,000. Bigger crowdsourcing efforts where it doesn't require a lot of high-tech stuff, we might send that to our entire database.
You basically have a credentialing system for GIS professionals on their skill set and what you can kind of narrow it down to, is that correct?
Right. When you register as a volunteer, which it's free to register, you just go to our website and find the sign up to volunteer button. And there's a form that you fill out that asks different questions on sort of your areas of interest and what skills you have and what sort of time commitments you might be interested in. Most of our projects we try to keep to 5 to 10 hours a week or 3 to 6 months, but those can vary greatly. The disaster response stuff is intensive. A lot of time all in one block. Our regular projects are sort of drawn out because most of our volunteers have full-time jobs, so they're doing this on nights and weekends.
Sure. Do you provide resources like software licensing or access to like portals like AGOL to help support the mission, or does the volunteer have to support those resources, have to have those resources already?
We usually encourage the partner agency to provide whatever is needed for the project. If they can't do that, we do have our own GIS Core AGOL that we can use. We also have, thanks to the generous donation from Esri, we have what's called a GIS service pledge, which acts in two different ways. The one way is if there is a project that comes in and a volunteer needs software, they can sign up for that and they'll get a 1-year home use license for free to conduct that project. The way that it works is a volunteer brings us a project that they say they work with a nonprofit and they see a good use of GIS for that nonprofit and they just want to do their own project with their own nonprofit. Then they can sign up for the GIS service pledge and also get a 1-year home use license. And that we require that they write a report at the end of their time to help show what they did.
That program is a really great way to reach organizations that might not even realize that they could benefit from GIS, or if they do, they might never have heard of GIS Corps, and so they'd never come and request a volunteer. Uh-huh. It's a way for volunteers to sort of find these organizations in their own communities, some organization or cause that they're passionate about, realize that they could help with their GIS skills, and then they apply through this program, and they're able to get the software to carry out the work.
Well, that's fantastic. I see this as an interesting opportunity. I mentioned before that there's like a lot of new lay users getting into GIS, a lot more than when I first started 25 years ago. I think it might be a fantastic opportunity to practice some unique skills that you may not get to use otherwise.
That's another thing is that often, since we have 7,000 volunteers in our database, when we have these typical projects like German described that only where we only recruit, you know, one or two volunteers to fill that role, There are a lot of people who haven't been chosen for a project and they can get kind of frustrated. This is a great outlet for them too, because they can design their own project, choose themselves, and then carry it out. It's another way to get involved where you might otherwise not be. I was looking through our GIS service pledge projects, and four of them jumped out at me as being related to public safety. One of them was a volunteer named Luis Ricardo Rodriguez in California, and he designed a new police beats map for Salinas in California, because they were using, I think, a hard copy map that had been made a long time ago, and it was, you know, kind of hard to read. He created a new digital map for them. Another one was a volunteer named Patrick Hall, who mapped the volunteer locations for the Los Angeles Fire Department. So I think it was their CERT program. All the volunteers who are in the area so they'd know where the volunteers actually are located so they could contact the nearest one to wherever there was a need. Uh-huh. And then another volunteer named Dave Hansen did a project doing some mapping for the American Red Cross. And Jim Kyle, who lives in British Columbia, did a really cool project where he mapped traumatic incidents and deaths in the Kootenays for an organization called CERPA, which I think is the Kootenay Emergency Response Physicians Association, or... I might not have gotten that exactly right, but yeah, so there are lots of opportunities to get involved with public safety GIS through that GIS service pledge program.
How do departments, say my department that I work for, we're pretty good, but like just my typical department, I work for Kirkland Fire, which has 100 folks, and some department, that example, how would a department like mine reach out to GIS Corps with a project idea to maybe get support for? Let's say, for example, coming off the top of my head, is mapping pedestrian accidents inside my jurisdiction, and I have no clue where to start. How would I go about contacting GIS Corps or figuring out a way to communicate addressing that need for us?
The one prerequisite typically is that you have to be a nonprofit. So I don't know if you're a, you know, a department of your city or county. It's a little different. Or maybe is it a volunteer fire department?
It's a city department. I'm just using mine as an example, just because that's the one I'm familiar with. My department, I live on Woodby Islands, is a volunteer department. Central Woodby.
If it's a volunteer nonprofit, you would reach out to us on our website. There's a request volunteers page, and you fill out the form. It's very similar to signing up to be a volunteer. Give us a little information about your organization, what you think you're looking for. Some details about what you're trying to do, how many people you think you might need, or maybe sometimes people know specifically exactly what they're looking for. Other times, groups really don't even have enough understanding of GIS to know what they need. Yeah. So what happens is that if we get a request for a project, somebody on the core committee usually adopts that project, and we set up a phone interview with the organization and we talk to them about what they're looking for. Some do basically a little needs assessment right there on the phone call to figure out what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And as a core committee, we write up a job description that we would then send out to our volunteers that describes what skills are needed, how long the project's expected to last, how many people they're looking for, if there's any specialty hardware or software you might need.
I could see a challenge would be scope creep, if you will, on a project, especially with the individual organizations. So I'm sure it's important
right.
to set some very clear boundaries, and this is the finish line, and we're not going any further than that.
Right. We do, as the core committee member that leads the project, it's our role to check in with the volunteer and the organization every month and make sure everything's on track and nothing wayward is happening. That exactly, that scope creep's not going on. That is a real thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we've all experienced, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we changed this to a different color?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I could do it real quick. And then it goes on and on from there. And eventually you're about 40 hours into it. Nothing. So
yeah, that's a constant challenge, and we are our own worst enemies on that one too, because we always want to do these cool things. So we have to dial it back sometimes.
Yeah, I think we should have a support club on overachieving GISers or whatever. I'm sure we've all experienced, hey, wouldn't it be nice? Actually, for me personally, I always cut it mm-hmm. off if that's the beginning statement. Hey, it'd be awesome if it did this.
Yeah.
So I learned that the hard way. We could kind of talking about before a bit about like some of the public safety missions that the GIS Corps has participated in. Can you guys just describe briefly a couple of key big projects you worked on, like the Southeastern Tornadoes or Hurricane Dorian that you all have worked on? Describe what the project was and then some interesting things about it.
I believe back in 2017, Paul's our role in public safety.
That guy.
He's created a lot of work for us, which is good and bad. He came to Charay, this was before I was on the core committee even, had this idea about crowdsourcing during hurricanes and having volunteers post pictures that they find on social media. And it was very hands-off in terms of GIS Corps at the first year or two. And then in 20, I think when, about when Aaron came along, when was that, 2018? 2018, Paul kept coming to us for these projects, and we would advertise them, but we weren't directly involved. We would just send the notice out to our volunteers. They would participate if they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, at the end, we'd close out the project and ask them how much time they committed, and that would be that. Well, then over the years, it's developed into a much more interactive process where Erin has built these amazing dashboards. That's how she sort of came to GIS Corps through Paul. Then we adopted her into our team. Paul basically comes to us and says, hey, there's a hurricane coming. Are you guys going to be able to activate? Erin and I and Holly, we actively manage the volunteers that sign up, and we engage back with them, and we try to keep people going. We're interacting with on daily phone calls with FEMA. The FEMA has a crowdsourcing group now that works with ourselves and other crowdsource groups like CEDAR and Standby Task Force. We have daily conference calls, and FEMA tells us their priorities for the day. We tell them what our volunteers might be finding. It's become more of an interactive project. And of course, ESRI changes what's happening on their software side every year. So each year we've been sort of slowly developing. Went from the crowdsource app to Survey123 to the attachment viewer. Now we're looking at a hub, and Aaron's been playing around with the experience builder and trying to make it as user-friendly for our volunteers as possible, so we don't have to be constantly on Slack and answering questions. And it's come such a long way since our first project. It's amazing how it's developed.
With the crowdsourcing map, can you kind of describe what it is? I'm trying to think of the best way. It appears to go two ways. You could click a point on the map and bring up a photo of the conditions, such as, you know, flooding or down trees or some sort of damage. Or if I remember correctly, it works the opposite way as well, where you could click on an image and it brings you to that location on the map. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's two different. Attachment viewer allows you to click the photo. You can scroll through. It's a gallery. You can see the photos, and we have them broken out. I think one of our attachment viewers is broken out by our FEMA Lifeline. You have your photo gallery. You can click on it. It brings up some information that the volunteer has input in the survey about that picture that they found. And then also we have on the map, you can click a point, and then it has a little pop-up window, and it'll show you the same information with a little photo based on all of that information comes from the survey that the volunteer inputs.
And where are you getting the photos from? I know they're coming from the public, but so the volunteer is researching where these photos were taken?
We have social media miners, Holly, and she's the genius in doing it. I don't know where she finds all these photos. But basically, just mine social media. Holly has a whole list of Twitter tags. And then also Cedar Digital helps us a lot on those and pulling in from mostly Twitter, some Facebook. And occasionally, Paul has roped in somebody from the field and they'll post a photo or two of their own. But I'd say what, like 98% or 99% of them are all come from social media. So we try to find photos that are timely, that can be geolocated, taking something in the photo and being, okay, I know where that is. Well, it's Podunk Town, Texas, and there's only one McDonald's, and there's the McDonald's, so it has to be here.
Right.
Those kind of photos, so that the people who are using the app on the ground, they can see and know a little bit more, and also to maybe FEMA, and they have the dashboard up, and they can see and know what the conditions are on the ground.
So yeah, when you grab these photos off Twitter, now I know most people don't even know how to shut it off, but so these photos are geotagged. They have a location to them. So when my point is when you pull these off Twitter, you're able to grab that information and link it to the map?
Yes and no. Actually, a lot of people nowadays know that there's a setting you can turn off. So we're seeing less and less of those. The volunteer is geolocating them themselves. So taking something in the photo or in the description that was tagged along with the post that says where that photo was taken. Sometimes gotcha. It could be down power lines, and the description said down power lines at such and such street in whatever highway. Then there's an estimated location right. For that photo.
There's a field on our survey 123 form that allows the volunteer to specify the level of accuracy to which they were able to locate that photo. So they can say whether they were able to pinpoint the exact location of the photo, whether they located it to the street level, the neighborhood level, the city level, or the county level.
When we first started working with Paul on this, it was 100% focused on hurricanes and huge events like that. When you have flooding across an entire state, the location of the specific photos may have been a little, we always tried to find at least located down to the county level. But then over time, we've dived in a little deeper. And for instance, this year, we've done our first tornado projects using the same workflow. And obviously a tornado track is very specific, and it's just practically a single line. So we have to be much more accurate on how we place the photos. So we encourage people to look for landmarks, street signs. Every now and then you get like the perfect photo with a street sign still standing.
Right.
Although with tornadoes, it could be down the street. So just because you see a cross street does not mean that's where a photo was taken.
Or even that one. You also look through the comments on the social media thread and see if anybody mentions the location, because a lot of people sometimes will be like, oh, I know where that's Jim's house on such and such street.
Right.
And, you know, you can get clues that way. And then we also use Google Street Map, Street View, or whatever your chosen Street View application is to help search around. And I've traveled many miles on roads back and forth trying to find a specific house with a big tree in the background.
To get the view just right.
Yeah, some of us can get really obsessive about getting the exact location. We have to realize we're spending too much time on this one photo. I think the big strength of these NAPSIG crowdsourcing maps that we put together is providing situational awareness in real time or close to real time to emergency operation centers and first responders who aren't actually on the ground in the area yet and are trying to decide where they need to go, how they need to allocate their resources, what they need to bring with them to be able to access these places. So it's a way to see, because as you zoom in on the map, it filters the photos in the gallery. So you have all of these little squares of photos on the left side of the screen. Mm-hmm. That's the gallery view. And as you zoom in on the map, the photos in that gallery view are filtered to just the ones in that map location, in the current map extent. An emergency manager can look at the specific area that they're concerned about, zoom in on it, and see photos with times and dates on them that are showing what the circumstances are on the ground right there, and then decide what they need to do about that area.
That's great information for emergency operations centers. Some of our most recent episodes where Chris and I have talked about applications going on with the coronavirus, some of the things that we talked about early on was trying to get data. We personally found it a little difficult. I was trying to find in my area here in New York, the mobile testing site locations. I had seen a lot of information on the news about it. As I started combing the internet, trying to find this information, I really struggled. The only thing I could find here in New York State was through the media outlets. Sometimes it was not a very good description. It was like some park up in New Rochelle, which I'm not from the New Rochelle area, so I don't know where this park is. I had gone to the New York State DOH website, figured maybe I could get some information off of there. No luck from that website. I came across the GIS Corps website and realized that you guys had a feature service of all the testing locations for coronavirus. I couldn't believe the amount of data that you had nationwide. I was so impressed on how you were able to collect this. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that, how you have these resources that you have in the volunteers and how you go about collecting that information and getting it onto a map.
Yeah, that's a work in progress. ESRI's disaster response program approached us, I think, on March 19th and asked if we'd be willing to set up a project where we tried to compile a nationwide roll-up of all of the testing site location information that was being shared at that time by individual counties and states, because it was just all these little pieces fragmented all over the place, and there was no single authoritative source of testing data for the whole country. We got to work on that. We recruited volunteers starting, I think, March 24th or 25th, and we got an amazing response. I think something like somewhere over 700 volunteers signed up for the project. Not all of them ended up actively creating any data, but hundreds did. And the way we structured it was we had each volunteer adopt the county that they're most familiar with, or hopefully more than one county, because there are over 3,200 counties in the United States and its territories. Hopefully some volunteers, we hoped that they would adopt several counties, or in some cases the whole state. And because we have, among our volunteers, we have many who work in state government, so a lot of them had access to this data more so than most people would. So it was really good set of people to work on this project, because some of them are well connected within state government or county government, and they were able to really know where to find the data that we needed. And then as the project progressed, these volunteers are continuing. So we were just creating all this data. At first, it was mostly government websites that we were looking at, but increasingly more and more private medical providers were offering testing from their sites as well. So now it's a big mixture of individual practices, government testing sites, large nationwide chains like CVS and Quest. It's just grown exponentially. At this point, we've got over 7,400 sites on our map that are on the public map. And we're collecting information not just about their location, but what their current status is, their contact information, their hours of operation, when they started testing, when they're planning to stop testing, what types of testing they're offering, because now we have molecular, which are the PCR tests that are used to diagnose. That's kind of the gold standard for diagnosing COVID-19. Mm. But we also have antibody tests out there. Now, just as of the last few days, there are also antigen tests that have been authorized by the FDA. We've been working, just like I was saying before, about how these disaster response projects tend to evolve during the course of the project. We've been adding new fields to the schema and giving the volunteers constant feedback on instructions for collecting these new types of data. Most of us don't have a medical background. We don't know what a PCR test is versus an antigen test, but we've all learned about it. Mm-hmm. And part of the credit for that goes to Jorge Caballero. He's a doctor in California who was a co-founder of another group called Coders Against COVID. And they put together a website called findcovidtesting.com, and they were kind of doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of teamed up with them right from the start. We met them in the FEMA crowdsourcing meetings since we both had the same goal, and they had this great team of software engineers and we had this huge volunteer base, so it was kind of a natural partnership. Jorge has been really valuable in our Slack channel, helping explain things like the different test types and pointing out different sources of information about different community-based testing centers. He's just been a wealth of information when it comes to the public health sector. And then we've provided all the manpower and the GIS expertise to bring together this data set.
That's incredible.
That is awesome. I was just going to compliment, I was like the first batch of responders in the United States to get quarantined for an exposure to COVID. And so 14 days, I spent a lot of time online. And it was interesting, my comment overall with this pandemic is it's amazing when you lock up every GIS person in their house, what they come up with.
Yeah.
And so I just applaud, like, all the stuff's all over the place. And it was neat to see, like, a cohesive strategy and workflow to actually do something disconnected like the GIS Corps did. My hat's off and a compliment just to doing something, because a lot of people would do different things. It just was all over the place. This was helpful and neat.
That's one of the great things about GIS Corps, like one of the great benefits to the volunteers themselves besides getting experience and things like that, but is the ability, and when a disaster strikes and you feel helpless and you want to do something but you don't know how to help, mm-hmm. it gives us an outlet where we can actually help from our homes and do something meaningful to support the people who are in the affected area. In this case, it's kind of weird because the difference with this COVID-19 testing sites project is it's like we're all in the affected area. Everybody's affected, no matter where you're working from. I think that's why we had such a good response to this project for the recruitment. Everybody's directly affected and everybody wants to help.
Your data sets for the testing locations, are your volunteers keeping them up to date, or are you like turning that over to, let's say, like the New York State Department of Health to say if they're open or they're closed or modified?
Yeah. Well, in some cases, we are coordinating closely with the states, and that's the best case scenario. So any other states who are out there listening, please get in touch. My favorite example is Texas. Texas approached us because they wanted to use our data in their testing site finder app on their website for the Department of Health and Human Services. They had found some problems with some of the points we had added, so we were able to correct those because of their feedback. We had points that they didn't know about. It was this great collaboration, and they ended up actually taking... Not only were they sending us, we have a template, so I can send any organization, whether it's an individual provider or a government, this Google Sheet template that shows exactly what data we need so that I can do a bulk upload, and then they can fill it out themselves, send it to us, and we'll just append it right to the data set. So that's one option. We also have a public form where states or any kind of testing provider can input their own testing site to add it to the map, and our volunteers just verify that the information is valid, and then it's on the map. And in the case of Texas, they took it a step further, and they actually had a couple of their GIS people who work for the state just join GIS Corps and be added to the project. So now they're right there in our volunteer portal with us, updating their sites directly. If I make a change to the schema, since they're using the data on their site, I can immediately just ping them on Slack and be like, hey, I added a domain value to that field. You might want to update your pop-up. It's a really great collaboration because the communication's going both ways and it's working out really well. If we had that kind of cooperation from all the states, it would just help us to create a more accurate and comprehensive data set. That's kind of the goal that we're going for. And we're working increasingly with lots of other states as well. Well,
obviously none of us know when this, I call it an incident, but none of us know how long this incident is going to go on. Do you have any plans of how long are you going to keep working on this data set? At what point do you say we're not going to support this layer anymore? If a state wants to take it over, they could do that. Or is it something that you will just continue to support for as long as needed?
That's something we're talking right now to both Esri and FEMA about, and I don't really have an answer yet. We're trying to figure out what's the exit strategy. It's important that the data remains available and up to date, but at the same time, these kind of intense disaster response projects don't usually last this long. It's a lot to ask of these volunteers to keep monitoring all these counties and keeping the data up to date. So I'm not really sure. My hope is that we'll get increased participation by all these states, and it can be brought down to just a skeleton crew who is just like accepting data from the states and updating it, or accepting data from the providers and updating it, not actually actively looking for the data ourselves anymore. But I don't really know if that's going to come to fruition.
You brought up an interesting point, and Chris and I have talked about this. This is just such a weird incident, typically an incident, whether be a tornado or a hurricane or a man-made disaster, usually within a week or two, things are somewhat back to normal. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily exactly back to normal. People in my area are still dealing with the effects of Hurricane Sandy 6 years later.
Yeah.
But this is just such a weird incident where it's going on for months. It's going to continue on for months. Just don't know when the end is going to be. So, and I thought, Holly, you put it in a good way there, that exit strategy.
Yeah.
It's just hard to determine what that exit strategy will be. So very interesting. German, when I had reached out to you and Erin and Holly about being on the episode, can you talk a little bit more about your GIS Service Pledge Program? And if anybody wants to get involved with the GIS Corps, how they can do that and about this program?
Sure. If you'd like to join GIS Corps, it is free. You don't have to pay anything. There are no dues. You go to our website and go to the sign up to volunteer link, and it'll take you to the form you fill out that gives us some of your background so we know which projects we can send to you. And typically, the way a normal project works, we send out a job description, we get resumes and letters back. We actually go through every single one and we shortlist people, and we do full interviews with people. For regular projects, you would get an interview, and then if you're paired with the project, then you go on and work directly with the partner agency. And there's the crowdsourcing projects, which are the more disaster response and public safety. We send out a blast to our database and you would get information on how to join the project and how to start working on it. And those don't require interviews or anything. So those are great for people that are just getting into GIS, maybe students that want to dabble in some things and sort of see different ways to use GIS. And then we have this GIS Service Pledge Program, which if you have, you do have to be a volunteer in our database. So that's, you know, just go ahead and sign up. If you do sign up, you get our quarterly newsletter, and then you'll get job descriptions on occasion for projects, but we don't send out a bunch of spam or anything like that. And then you can apply for the GIS Service Pledge. If you have a group, maybe you love dogs and your local humane society you see a need for some sort of GIS project for them, you could bring us that project and apply for the GIS Service Pledge. We would review your project proposal basically, and if we approve it, you will get a 1 year free license, a home use license from Esri to use the software, and you would get an AGO account. We try to discourage personal AGO accounts in this case, just because we do want to encourage a long-term result from the project. We would encourage the shelter or whoever to have their own AGO account, but it can be done. Yeah, we've had a lot of great success with that program.
I just want to mention, so people know, with the home use license from ESRI, that pretty much gives you, I want to say, about 80% of their software, meaning the desktop software and ArcMap and ArcGIS Pro. It does give you a personal ArcGIS online account. But German, as you mentioned, you would rather them be logging into your AGOL. It also gives you access to all the apps that they have, the Collector app, Survey123, the Explorer app. There are a few apps, I believe, like Navigator, that's not included in there, but it really gives you a lot for that personal license. So.
That's right. And also it gives you access to all the training.
Yes, that's a good point.
Which is a big asset for people who are kind of trying to build their GIS know-how.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Thank you for saying that. I've personally taken quite a bit of their training under my personal license that I have. That's an excellent point. I'd like to thank the three of you for being on our episode. It's been a very good knowledge for myself personally. I've always known about the GIS Corps. I read a few things. We have made some references to the organization in other episodes, but this has definitely been very insightful for myself.
Yeah, I'm even considering volunteering myself.
Great.
Good.
There's no pressure. Just because you sign up doesn't mean you're, required. If you get a job description and you think it sounds cool, you can apply.
Paul Doherty bosses me around anyway. You might as well give him another app to do it.
Oh, and I should mention, anyone who participates in our projects, we ask them to track their hours, and those hours can be used towards your DISP certification.
I thank all three of you for joining us. Chris and I have been exploring other communication tools to join the public safety GIS community together. Recently, we started our own Slack page called Mapping Tech in Public Safety. If anybody would like to join that Slack channel, please feel free to reach out to us and we'll be more than happy to invite you. We'll be putting that up on social media as well. And then most recently, Paul Doherty from NAPSIG has given me the permissions to help with the National Alliance for Public Safety GIS Slack channel. I've actually joined that myself, and I will say that there's quite a few members on there already. There's some good conversations. He's given me administrator rights to start some new channels on the Slack page. So I've already started specific ones for the fire and EMS, law enforcement, incident management. And I'm trying to get members to join those specific pages to just discuss ideas, tips, and tricks for GIS applications within those public safety fields.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Mapping Tech and Public Safety. Feel free to reach out to us at our blog at the website mappingtechandpublicsafety.com.